Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is brought to you by Cento at cento.com, Colavita at colavita.com, and Wines of Portugal at winesofportugal.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey folks, welcome to Food Talk. Mike Colomeco here. Got a great show lined up. It feels like we're in Seattle. It has been raining in New York City for the last 3 days. In fact, yesterday we broke a record. That's right. Not every day you can say that. We broke a rain record. 1.51 inches of rain hasn't happened before on that day. That means I've been relegated to not riding a bicycle, mass transit, the subway, and delays. God, getting around New York on the subway is such a pain
it's
in the
brutal.
Neck. Brutal. Went to a concert last night, lots of fun, had a great meal. A couple nights ago, had a great one. Shout out to David Santos, the chef at Loro, a little restaurant in the West Village, West 10th Street, right off of Greenwich Avenue. Great guy, great restaurant. The guy does everything in-house, completely stoked chef. Love him.
He's badass.
Also hung out this week with a couple people. My first guest, well, everybody knows everybody in this business, but Mike Price, Joey Campanero at the Clam. Great spot. Those guys are killing it there. Hard-working chefs, my kind of people, salt of the earth. Went to see the Allman Brothers last night. It's the last stand for the Allman Brothers, man. Four more gigs at the Geekin. At the Beacon. Listen to me. I can't speak English. All right, slow down, Mike. Yeah. They've been playing the Beacon for, like, I think 40 years.
I'm not on the scene.
Whatever. They've been playing, and I'm old enough to remember, like, the original Allman Brothers with Dwayne when he was alive, because he didn't live. I mean, he died at 26, I think. That was a killer band, the beginning of Southern Rock, that they were there. And Dwayne was just still, to this day, on anybody's list, one of the top 10 rock blues guitarists. But Greg Allman's carried the banner of the Allman Brothers forward. And this current band's been around for about 25 years, 20 years plus or minus, Well, Derek Trucks is kind of newish, but Warren Haynes on guitar. Anyway, this is it. This is the last four concerts. They're going to break up, and who knows what happens. I suspect as long as Greg is alive, there'll be some kind of Allman Brothers band around. The concert was good last night. I got a complaint. I want to say this one more time. Would people shut up during concerts? I got one more concert where people were just talking through all the songs. I hate that. Like, you're here to see the band. I actually didn't stay for the whole concert because the guy next to me insisted on singing along with the songs.
Yeah, I went to the Stones last year in Philly, and I almost had a meltdown. Like, I'm like, listen, I want to hear Mick singing it. I don't want to hear your terrible voice.
Midnight Rider. I got one more. I paid to listen to Greg Allman sing,
exactly.
Not the asshole next to me
who's
out of key. Like, dude, shut up.
I agree.
Like, nobody wants to hear
on
you.
On top of that, and then you're trying to enjoy the show, and then homeboy right behind you has got the video camera with the light flashing, and I'm just this has ruined my experience.
Correct.
I'm like, I don't want to be the ass to, like, tell you to shut the F up, but I'm trying here.
Please. I mean, can we get some kind of... And I had the same thing happened this summer at a concert. I went to see Conor Oberst at the Central Park, and I kind of... Same thing happened to me. I'm like, why did you go to a concert and have a conversation? If you're going to talk, go to a bar. If you want to talk to your best friend, just get on the phone or hang out outside or go to a diner. We're at a concert, man.
Anyway,
my first guest who's listening to all this ranting and ravings, Harold Dieterle. Harold, cool guy, great chef. And if you don't know the name, you may, because he was there at a moment when food TV history was being made. Okay, put your hats on. We're not talking about the Food Network. We talked about that enough last week. Not a big fan here, personally, of the Food Network or the Food Channel and what they churn out, which is mostly pablum, garbage, and those of little talent teaching those with less. But enough about that. The game changer I'm talking about was Top Chef. Game changer. Great chef Tom Colicchio gets tapped. What do they call that production company? Little Owls? Magical Owls?
Magical Elves.
Magical Elves, thank you. Magical Elves, who had just come off Project Runway. They had a hit. They had some juice. They had this idea for a chef competition show. Tom Colicchio is a chef.
Yep.
I don't know who the girl was on season one. Maybe it was Padma.
Katie Lee Joel. Katie Lee.
Oh, God.
Well, she's great. She's great.
Is she? Okay.
Yeah, she's really smart. She's really witty.
Okay.
It was just one of those things where
that chemistry didn't work?
Yeah, it was early in her career, and she was, like, figuring it all out, and I don't think they were managing her that great, but she's really smart. She knows a ton about food. And
you were the winner. Season one, Harold was the winner,
yeah.
And it was huge because that show kicked the TV Food Network's butt in terms of Nielsen's.
Yeah.
And it must have launched you into orbit from going. What was your gig prior to that? What were you doing?
I was the executive sous chef at the Harrison up until New Year's Eve 2006. So
Joey Campanaro was a chef.
Joey was my first chef, then Brian B. Strong,
right.
And then Jimmy was,
overseeing everything.
The master at arms at all
got
times.
Got you. So from there you went from Chef de Cuisine to winning Top Chef.
Yep.
To people approach you saying, we want to open up a restaurant.
It wasn't that romantic.
Well, come on. Look at that. The next day.
Yeah. I was trying, we were trying to raise money, Alicia, my business partner, for about a year. And, it took some time. So we opened Perilla in May 2007.
We're here to talk about a couple of things. One of them is your book.
Yeah.
Name of the book is, I don't have it in front of me.
Harold Dieterle's Kitchen Notebook.
Harold Dieterle, that's Dieterle. Harold Dieterle's Kitchen Notebook. We'll have a link on this website and a picture of the book or the cover of the book. It was co-written by Andrew Friedman, who is a pro at this business. He's been doing this for a long time. He's going to be our guest in a minute. He just showed up. He was stuck in traffic trying to come from Brooklyn to Brooklyn. That'll happen. But I really, I have to say, I mentioned to you off microphone, I get sent, I guess since my WOR radio days, I'm constantly sent cookbooks, but you're on that list and they just find their way to you. And 95% of them, I'm just like, A, why? Do we need another book on whatever this stupid topic is? And then if I'm curious enough to even open them up, I'm like, look at these recipes. These don't work. Like, who wrote this? Did anybody vet this stuff? It's a funny industry because I think there's money out there and they're always looking for the one that sells they didn't expect because that's the one they make money on. But the majority of them are just pitiful. I got this book, and of course, Andrew, welcome. You can need that microphone as close to you, but you've done this before.
Thank you.
Andrew Friedman just showed up. Great. He's in. So I started reading this thing, and I love the beginning of it where you're talking about growing up on Long Island,
yep.
Doing something in high school or a couple days a week. You're doing some kind of tech program
yep.
thing, which, again, you're kind of your family's cooking. And you're talking about notebooks. And I'm just laughing because you're in between the generations. Like, my generation, that's all we had.
Yeah.
There were no cell phones. There were no cameras. You had Ring. And we still have them. I still have them. If I talk to Frankie Crispo or Rick Moonen or Charlie Palm or any of the guys, you would come home from work that night,
yep.
Carry it to work with you. And they're all stained and bloodied.
Yeah, it's
and
disastrous.
You'd come home from work and you would draw a picture of the special and you'd have like, this was where the string beans went and this was the steak and this was the sauce and here's the recipe for the reduction. It was kind of like a purgle. And then specific recipes for stuff that you would learn.
Yeah, I think it was a couple different ways. I mean, I learned very early on that I was not the drawing guy. Because my pictures were disastrous.
So were mine.
But
at least the plates were kind of round.
Exactly. But, there was a couple different ways. Like, I would write down recipes, and then when I got to the point in my career where I wanted to start creating stuff, there would be, dish ideas, concepts. And then they either went from that process and made it to become a recipe, or we took the Sharpie, we crossed them out and said, this is dog. It's not going forward.
But that's the way that sort of pick and shovel, trial and error, by hand, by rote. And again, we didn't have phones. I mean, we didn't have cameras. That's like very, like, last 5 or 6 years, I think,
yeah.
in the industry. Before that, everything had to be done by memory. It's a really good book, and I think that it's kind of draws, I think, for people that are nervous, because it's funny how people are nervous about cooking. Like, for you and I, it's like, intuitive.
Yeah.
Like, open the refrigerator, even to make dinner, it's like, I got this, done. But it kind of gives people that great sense that this isn't rocket science. Here's a primer on some ingredients. Here's some kitchen equipment you're going to need. Here's technique basics, and proceed. And Andrew, thanks for showing up today. I know it's tough.
I'm so sorry.
No,
this is the
busy.
First time I've ever been often late with book deadlines, never late to a radio interview.
Don't worry about it. Luckily for us, this is internet web streaming radio, not the old WOR broadcasting, where we actually had hard breaks that we worried about. You started in the cookbook thing. Tell me if I'm wrong. Was your first Alfred Portale's book
Gotham Barn Grill Cookbook was
1990?
Came out in 97, I think, possibly 98. I always forget which, but Yeah, I think it was fall of 97 that it pubbed.
So 20 years later, nearly 20 years later, how many books?
Oh, it's coming up on 30.
That's great. That's great. And some titles.
Mostly cookbooks.
Yeah, mostly cookbooks.
Some memoirs that I've helped with, and then some of my own nonfiction.
It's great stuff. Great. Well, Liz, congratulations on the two of you working together. Great book, really well written. Love the voice of the book. Love the recipes, the layout.
Thanks.
I don't know who photographed it, but the pictures are great.
We used Dan Krieger.
Oh, Dan, our buddy with Jordana. He's a rock star.
Yeah, he did a nice job. And we used an illustrator named Eve Hammer.
I should have known Daniel shot that book. He's so bloody good. So let's talk about some of the recipes. And they're vetted, too, which is this is another thing about this book. And this is why, give me the title one more time. We're going to do this a couple times during the show.
Harold Dieterle's Kitchen Notebook.
So we did the Top Chef thing, launches you in orbit. You open up Perilla, the first restaurant.
Yep.
Then second restaurant, Kin Shop.
Yep.
Thai-inspired. You love, it's kind of like that Andy Ricker's story in a way. And so Perilla's how many years? 10?
No, Perilla's 8.
Okay. One of the dishes on the Perilla menu, I believe, or the last time I was there it was, which is a while ago, was that fried watercress and squid salad.
Yeah,
it just opens the book. Is that one of the first recipes in the book?
It's in the first chapter of the book.
Okay.
Yeah, it's in the salad.
It kind of goes
chapter.
By apps, salads, soups, kind of follows the normal way you'd eat a meal with desserts at the end and meats
correct.
And proteins that way. So it's a logical following. Talk about that recipe because it's so cool. And it was, again, kind of Thai-inspired.
Yeah. My first trip to Thailand, I had a dish where it was kind of the traditional chilled seafood salad with a chili lime vinaigrette with some tempura watercress on top of it. So I decided to just take the calamari and the watercress, tempura it all together, and then make a similar dressing.
Which is funny, because the first time I saw that, I'm like, what's he doing? Because everything's in a mixing bowl, and then you have this really kind of light tempura-ish battery. Watercress, everything goes in there, boom, into the basket of a fryer.
Yeah.
So it's kind of this wilted, warm, mashed-up salad, and it's just a flavor bomb.
Yeah, we had to work on the wording of it for a little bit on the Perilla menu, because the first couple weeks it was on, people like, it says crispy, and they just expect the watercress to be crispy, but not cooked and deep-fried. So
because it's a surprise.
It's a surprise. And then people are like, wow, they're like, this isn't really what I expected. And I had to, let the servers know they needed to talk to people.
Yeah, especially
because
kinds, not to be judgmental, but the people that are ordering salads to start a meal are probably ordering them because they're leafy greens with light vinaigrette on them. I never order salads. It's like I can make salads until I'm blue in the face. It's like there's got to be a more interesting starter to me than roasted beets or a salad on a menu. But maybe that's just me.
Yeah.
Anyway, so how hard was it to write this book? Because I know you guys, and I know you, every recipe was vetted. A couple of years? How long was the process?
A little more than a year to actually write it. But the first thing we have to do, as most people have to do, is write a proposal.
Did you hear this story?
This is actually a funny story.
You got to hear this story.
I know the drill, but
in the midst of a proposal, okay? And the funny thing was you look at this idea, and it's one of those ideas to me, it's kind of like when David Waltuck did the Staff Meals book.
What book? You didn't do the Staff Meals
book. No, I didn't do that book.
His big tome.
I did the Coffee book. Table Chanterelle
yes.
book. But Staff Meals, it was one of those things,
brilliant.
And I didn't even know the Waltucks at that point. But when I saw that book come out, you do the V8, smack yourself on the forehead, and you say, why didn't I think of that? That was just sitting there to be done. Other people have done notebook, not quite like this, but, Michelle Brau had this series of notebooks, very different animal. Harold and I, for the longest time, were having a hard time coming up with a concept. And I had actually started to write on my blog a little bit about that. And then when we cracked the code and came up with this idea as a way to sort of get all of his ideas between two covers, I wrote about that. I put the concept out there on my site, and we never ended up finishing the proposal. A book editor read the blog post, and we ended up selling it off the post. But
okay, skip C, D, E, from A to the end.
But the point being, we were in the middle of that process. So we already had a strong concept. We already had sort of a blueprint. So a lot of times when you start writing a book, that work, which you have very little to show for it in terms of actual words on the page, but that conceptualizing and organizing, that takes a lot of time.
Right. The proposal takes a shit ton of time.
Yeah. Once you have...
in your head.
Once you have a roadmap and a clear concept, often, for me anyway, you know, it just comes together like dominoes. Like, it's really quick. So when we started writing, we were out of the... I mean, we knew, okay, these are the recipes. We had all those lists. So it was... once we started doing that, it was pretty straightforward. The notebook stuff took a little work. For example, I'll give you an example. Originally, there was going to be a side dishes chapter in the book. I always think those are great because you can use those with whatever cooking you're doing, you know. But all the ideas that would have ended up being sides were already used up in the notebook portions of this book because they were kind of interesting ways to use an ingredient or an herb or whatever. So there is no side dish chapter in the book. The side dishes are sort of scattered throughout the notebook entries. Yeah. So that there was a little bit of adjusting as we went along.
Cool. Congratulations on the easy sell. Give the listeners who might not know you by name yet your blog's name.
Oh, thank you. So my blog is called Tokeland, and that
Q-U-E.
Important distinction is T-O-Q-U-E.
Correct.
L-A-N-D. A toque, of course, being the white chef's hat.
That we used to wear.
That people don't really wear anymore.
With those, look at those locks, man. You had to put a hat on that thing?
I had to put a hat on that thing, I remember. And I think for a while we were wearing neckerchiefs, too, way back in the day. Sorry,
brutal.
Dates, I know. But that was like old French kitchens, man. Yeah. That was part of that thing. Don't ask me why. Like, it wasn't hot enough in the kitchen?
Right.
Like wearing polyester uniforms wasn't bad enough. It was it was this thing. So the recipes are great. So talk about the and I love the pictures, and I also like the inventiveness. So I've always loved eating. I don't know why. Either hot steak. I had it last night. I had skirt steak, and I covered it with just this field blend salad I'm getting from Cape May that's still growing. Lightly vinaigrette, and so skirt steak's bloody and fatty, and the foil is... And I've always even loved, like, iceberg and romaine lettuce with bloody red meat. I just love that combination.
Yeah, one of my favorite things is I almost always, when I go to a steakhouse, I'll order my steak, and as my side, I want my Caesar salad with it.
Because it's just... Right, same time.
Right, same time.
Yeah.
Same time. I don't like to start with my Caesar and then have my steak.
Something about that coolness and the crunch and the liquid quality of romaine against the fatty, gnarly...
Yeah.
That just works perfectly.
Yeah, it's great.
So you have... So I'm flipping the pages, and you've got this beef carpaccio, and I'm like, I want that.
Yeah.
That looked so good. So talk about that, and we'll give a shout-out to... my next guest is going to be Jimmy Bradley in a little bit. Jimmy's coming in. If he gets here, you never know with the L train or traffic. But
yeah, that was one of the first dishes that I put on the Harrison menu with my chef at the time, Joey Campanero, and I was working on this carpaccio dish. I had all the flavors all set up, and he showed me this really fun way to present it, where you bang the beef out in between two Ziploc bags, two Ziploc bags,
right,
and then you lift the one Ziploc bag, you fill your, put salad on top of it and fold it over with a knife, and you kind of make it looks like a Japanese roll, so to speak.
It does. So the meat's on the outside. Yep. Watercress, I believe, was arugula was a salad in your recipe.
Yep.
There was a great sauce to go with it with capers, so it's kind of playing on steak tartare, these familiar flavors. But then you can pick your fingers up and just eat the thing, and you're going to get that kind of richness of that I guess you might use filet or top round for this?
Either one.
And the idea, it's funny because that's so restaurant style. I mean, early on at some point, pounding meat's hard because you can't – those big – cast aluminum pounding things, they just chew the meat up, so you can't really hit the meat with those.
Right.
Not if you're trying to make cutlets. So I remember early on just using, we'd recycle those plastic shopping bags from Chinatown or plastic wrap or something. It's a great idea. Just get you really thin.
I mean, that's what my grandmother used to do when she was doing schnitzel when I was a kid growing up. It was a similar situation that, you know.
You have schnitzel on the menu, too. I didn't have it in my notes, but talk about... I was at Batard. You've been to Batard yet, Andrew?
I have not, embarrassingly.
So the chef's Marcus Glocker, Austrian descent, of course, French training, and that menu kind of wobbles between those two countries, really. Great technician. And he's got, there's a couple of schnitzels in town I love. One's the one that Wolfgang serves up at Seasonal up on 58th Street. Great, great kitchen in there. And Marcus's is amazing.
Yeah, I think it's stylistically, when it comes to schnitzel, it's like, it kind of depends on what camp you're in. Are you in the camp of it gets deep fried and you want it seen very souffle-y? Or do you like to cook it in oil and baste it with butter? That's how my grandmother used to do it, so that's kind of where I stand on it. But I liked the Batard schnitzel very much. I thought it was excellent.
Which is the opposite one. I do mine cast iron on the stove, but it's deep fried.
Yeah.
And I shake the oil so it's waving across the top.
Yeah.
And if you flour, egg wash, some kind of crumb. Yeah. And if you do it right, it almost invariably
is
the entire thing or parts of it.
Well, the beauty, the reason why I'm with you and I prefer doing it that way is because you can baste it with butter. If you drop it into the deep fryer, there's no you can't get the butter into it.
Yeah, and butter.
We know what butter does.
It's butter.
Exactly.
Soft shells. Talk about that. Great. One of the great. We all try and eat seasonally. We all try and eat locally. Winters just suck. I mean, at some point, I'm so sick of eating root vegetables.
Yeah, and, well, sure.
You know, it's just if I see one more rutabaga, if I make one more stew with lentils and heirloom carrots, I'm going to puke. I want spring to come. And the last couple of winters we've had up here have been nasty
brutal.
And long.
Yeah.
This spring, I think, started 30 days late. I mean, literally, it was a month behind.
Yeah.
We were eating stuff in July that we usually eat the beginning of June, and it got pushed all the way down. But one of the harbingers of spring for me down in Cape May is the shad run. So we get shad roe, asparagus when they pop up, because they'll pop up with rhubarb, and soft shells.
Yeah.
They're early. That's like one of the great American delicacies.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, the one thing I will say that I love from a restaurateur, the fact that we're able to get, you know, because they've figured out how to farm raise, and I'm not a huge farm raised fish fan at all, but the fact that they've learned how to, you know, kind of mimic the moon cycles. And allow you to get soft shell crabs almost, I mean, not year round, but a good 6 to 8 months, is really cool.
Used to start in the spring and be over by pretty much August.
Yeah.
At some point, the shells would get harder and harder. The shedders weren't as soft as they used to be.
Yeah.
And then you're like, this ain't a soft
crab
anymore.
No, you can't do it. It's not a hard shell either. I don't know what to do with it.
Chewing leather.
Exactly.
But there's such a delicacy because you get to eat the entire thing. So you've got the sweetness of the crab meat, the crunch of the skin.
Yeah.
The way I always do, I mean, when I had my restaurant, it was one way, but I've always liked buttermilk. It just gives you a little bit thicker outside. And then some kind of seasoned flour with sesame or whatever you want to put in it, and then pan fry.
So versatile.
So versatile. And then you just eat the whole bloody thing, so it's sweet and crunchy.
I mean, a sandwich for me is like the epitome of summer with a nice slice of whatever kind of tomato you're getting. And put the two of them on.
Talk about your soft shell recipe.
Sure. It's kind of another variation on a Thai dish that I had when I was down there. I had them when they were pretty much just deep fried with a whole lot of garlic. And we're doing it, and they served it on the side with just some passion fruit pulp, just some split passion fruit. We scooped it out, and I've done a little bit more of a refined version of it. I made a passion fruit vinaigrette, and we did some kind of like some Siamese watercress kimchi with ramps, because it's that thing where it's you get them both right at the beginning the beginning of late spring, and I love using ingredients that kind of become available together.
My guests are Harold Dieterle, who is a chef in Manhattan, and Andrew Friedman, who they co-wrote this book together. Harold's a chef. Andrew's a great, great food writer in this space. I thank you for including the idea of using farro, whole grain, more or less, as a risotto substitute. Talk about that dish, too, because it's really, I mean, farro doesn't, it's kind of, I mean, outside of like certain circles, you don't see farro being used much. And I think I remember you also. I'm a big fan of people eating more whole grains anyway. Not that I'm a health nut, but they're way better for you than processed foods. And I remember you had forbidden rice on one of your menus that you use black rice, red rice. With that space of whole grain cookery is kind of opening up now.
I think so too. I mean, they actually. I've recently picked up this really fun tool. It's called the Wonder Mill. And it allows you to pretty much put any type of grain or anything. I mean, we were grinding, in the fall when we're getting some heirloom dried corn, you can make amazing polenta with it. I'm really into whole grain cooking, and the farro, I love the texture of the rice in that application. I'm not a huge arborio rice or Violani Nano or any superfino rice. I much prefer to eat. I love the complexity of the farro.
So do I, because it's nuttier, it's more toothsome. I mean, risotto is great, but it's kind of glorified baby food in a way.
Yeah, and in my opinion, it's also I also think risotto is also the most bastardized dish cooked in America.
But then to do it right, I mean, we're not talking about how restaurants actually pick it up and how they pull it off at service. You know, bar cooking it and then finishing it up because it's an 18-minute pickup otherwise.
Correct.
Which is. In a busy restaurant, unless you've got a risotto station and the guy's working for free, it ain't happening.
Yeah. Do you remember there was a scene in Big Night when someone orders risotto and the chef takes a pot off the rack to start the whole process? And it just seemed like, didn't these guys do their homework? I thought that was the craziest
But that's how Good Chef would do it, I guess. I mean, that's how you...
There wasn't even stock. I mean, I remember that scene.
You got to have stock. I mean, you have to have hot stock on the side. I mean, you're adding hot stock to, you know, 2 ounces at a time, basically. I mean,
you also like Ferrotto more because it's less... You don't have... It's not as...
Well, yeah, you're not activating...
It's not as labor-intensive.
It's not labor-intensive. I mean, to be honest, like, it's not really fair to call it a risotto, even though it is that cooking method, but you're really developing the creaminess with dairy and cheese.
Risotto in quotes. I mean, I saw this Michel Richard, who's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant chef. I mean, forget the New York thing that happened. That was an anomaly. But Citronelle, I've eaten there over the years, and he is just off the charts brilliant. Pastry chef who gets into the hot side, doesn't have a background. I mean, he was doing stuff with potatoes I've never seen, still does. And he was doing kind of a risotto with Idaho potatoes, grated on a mandolin, cut small, and then just getting that potato starch to escape, having a good stock in there. Yeah. And you're eating this going, what am I eating? Yeah. But it's brilliant and it's delicious.
That's right. That's what very, very cool dish. Yeah, it's about activating the starches.
Yeah, all about that stuff. Gastrique. How did Gastrique make its way into your book? That's so funny. Because that's such a kind of a funny... Again, my generation, like we... When you're my age and you used to work in those old French kitchens, because it was that... You know, you started in Garmager, and then you were an entremetier, and then maybe a poissonnier or a tournant, and then... But you dreamt of being a saucier. That was like guy that came in early and had the bones and the pots and the... That was the job you wanted. I remember even at culinary school doing exhaustive research on sauces, like it did me any good ever. But it was just a fascinating thing, right?
Yeah.
But Gastrique was one of those great bases, particularly for like duck and game sauces, where you'd start with sugar and an acid.
Yep.
You talk about why it... Why you love it and how it ended up in the book, either of you pick it up.
I think, you know, we were kind of talking when we were putting the book together and how we were going to make it a little different. And Andrew had said, like, you know, you have use of textures, you have the different sauces and everything. And we were just kind of like, we were rattling off different ideas and how it all made sense to us.
Yeah. I mean, the way I always say to start a book with a chef is... You know, the term, not literally, but I always say, like, put everything on the table, right? Usually it's actually just making lists. And what everything is this is the stuff I'd like to have in my book. And then you kind of back into what's the idea and what's the structure to fit it all in. You know, maybe 5% doesn't fit in this particular book. But we got almost, I think, everything in at the end of the day. So that's why there's sections throughout this book. Like, there's... Most of the notebook entries fit on one page, and there's
And they're different colors, aren't they? Slight brown or something, or am I imagining?
Yeah, they're different colors.
They're different colors when you get to right.
And the notebook entries have an illustration where the actual dishes have photographs, because we wanted each one of those elements to have their own look. But most of those notebook entries, so we'll take like cilantro. If there's cilantro in the recipe, the notebook page that accompanies it, there might be three or four ways to use it. It all fits on one page.
Yeah.
But then there's a few places where we really blew it out. So like, Harold loves curry, you know, and he...
I've noticed.
And he wanted to have, what do we have, five or six curries? Well, that's actually a notebook entry that just happens to run a couple of pages because that was important to him, you know. So that's what I mean by finding how does it fit in.
And where was the Gastrique?
Gastrique was one of these...
Yeah, Gastrique was in what dish we used? The Gastrique was in the squab dish. We did a fish sauce Gastrique with some foie gras, so it's got two different types of game, some caramelized salsify.
Dish. Yeah. I love squab.
Yeah,
medium rare.
Yeah,
get that breast just like cut it open. Heart still beating.
Yeah, we take the legs and we confit them and pick the meat with the sauté, and then we take the breast and we stuff the foie gras on the inside. And we make a roulade with col fat and slice it. It's a pretty dish.
Oh man. All fat. That's playing. Chicken soup with dumplings. Love that idea. It made me want to go home and try that thing. Talk about that. It sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
And even stock. I mean, we'll back it up a little bit because I try and get people to buy whole chickens at home.
Yeah, and make their own stock.
Right, and just look, because they're so easy. I mean, they may as well come with zippers. They're so easy to bone out if you want to do it that way. Get that carcass. I mean, you can make almost every time I put your chicken, let's make a little bit of stock. So I've got lots of these little containers of frozen stock, and then you build soups from them.
Yeah, this is a very Germanic dish that, I had my grandmother making... You know, a chicken style noodle, and I kind of just took it a step further by making little dumplings out of some graham pretzel.
You work your way through all the proteins. I love the fish selections, and we could go on for the whole hour, but we don't have the whole hour. We will bleed into the next part. you do fish, you do meats, you do all that stuff. And then I'm getting to the dessert point. I'm like, what's he going to do for dessert? Because as a chef, it's a little weird kind of, I'll speak for myself.
Whatever you're going to say, I'm probably going to agree
with you. It's the other half of the brain. Exactly. Real baking, it's like classical music versus jazz and blues. You play the notes on the page in classical music, and if you want to add your little, you know, thing with the bow or something, Bach wrote it, Beethoven wrote it, that's what it is.
Agreed.
And that's a different skill set than we have as chefs, because we just like to improvise and play, and we like the space in between the notes. And so you had these really good kind of chef-driven, because I looked at most of them and thought, that's either I've done that, like the blueberry buckle kind of thing. Right. All you got to do is make streusel.
Exactly. It's not so hard.
You can skip doable. The crust if you want. I bake mine in just a glass or in a ramekin.
Buy a pie shell, whatever you want to do. A lot of versatility there.
And I didn't know you worked with Karen. Shout out to one of my favorite pastry chefs, Karen Damasco.
She's a badass.
She's way badass. Yeah. We miss her. I guess she's home with the babies now. But anyway, talk about that dessert, because that just looks that steamed pudding.
Yeah, I mean, that was...
Lemon pudding, sorry.
Yeah, so that dish was one of the dishes she put on. It was a Meyer lemon steamed pudding. And she put it on the menu at Bella Femina when we opened up in New York City. And she would make fresh every day. So, you know, I was definitely past puberty at that point, but I didn't act like it because I was eating the steamed pudding with a glass of milk at the end of service every night while everybody else was getting tanked and drinking cocktails. So that was it. And you can do pretty much whatever you want with that. We can, you know, you can do a kaffir lime steamed pudding. We're doing passion fruit inside, in the book, so it's one of my favorite desserts.
Name of the book again?
Harold Dieterle's Kitchen Notebook.
Andrew Friedman co-authored it with Harold Dieterle. Those have been my guests. They're actually going to stay if they want. Stay a little bit because it turns out that it's New York. Everybody knows everybody. We've worked together. We've hung out together. We've broken bread together. Jimmy Bradley will be my next guest. But Harold Dieterle, this is one of you. Don't see me shilling for books much on this show. It's a great book. It's just in time for the holidays. It's a great gift. It's a book that you're going to use if you buy it and you want to follow recipes that are chef-driven, chef-inspired, and that will work, which separates it from about 99% of what's out there in the book world, in my world of food books anyway. Stay tuned. You'll listen to Mike Colenko's Food Talk. We'll be back after a quick break with Jimmy Bradley, another New York chef of some legend. And my guest will stay on, and we'll just do this, Chef Talk. Be back. Hey folks, Mike Colenko here. When I want to make great tomato sauce at home, it really starts with the best. For years and years and years, I've been using Cento brand San Marzano tomatoes. You know, it's funny. I use them because they had this great reputation as being a great tomato. I cut them against other samples of tomatoes when I had my restaurant back in the day and was a chef that was in charge of purchasing and just thought they were great. So I knew in my mouth that I liked them. But I had to see why. So, about 7 or 8 years ago, I went on a trip to the San Marzano region, which sits just outside of Naples, Italy, really in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius. It looked nothing like I expected. Most of the farms are small farms, small family farms. They've got a really long season, about 5 or 6 seasons, actually. Starts in April or May and runs through October, November. Beautiful volcanic soil, incredibly clean water, just great tomatoes. All of Cento's San Marzano tomatoes, from the seeds to the fields to the production facility, are certified by an independent agency, which guarantees the traceability. So when you're looking for great tasting canned tomatoes, look no further. Spend the extra couple of pennies. Look for that bright yellow Cento can. Yeah, it's the best. It's what I use. It's what great chefs use in their kitchens because, frankly speaking, there's nothing like it. Hey, folks, Mike Colenko here. Years back when I had my own restaurant, I had to figure out what kind of oils to use, you know, try to make money in the restaurant business. So, the most expensive oil wasn't the choice, but I had to use an oil that was great, an oil that I would use at home and also for my customers. Came upon Colavita olive oil, which to this day still stands head and shoulders above everybody in that extra virgin category in the supermarket shelves. So much of the extra virgin category is dominated by labels that sound like they're Italian. You know, they end with an O or something like that. But the truth is they're tank farm blends that come out of Italy, but what's in the jar or the can is oils from all over the world that are just spot on price. It's commodity oils. Colavita is the only one that's an extra virgin that's 100% Italian origin traceable. It's a great company. They really built their brand on the U.S. market. They get the U.S. market. So if you're looking for a super extra virgin olive oil, use the one that I've been using for years on my table at home and in my restaurants wherever I was hanging my chef's toque, and that would be Colavita Extra Virgin. True Italian, great oil.
couple of years ago, for the first time, I got to visit Portugal. Don't ask me why I never had. I'd been all around it. Been to France, been to Spain, been to Italy, been all over Europe, but for some reason not Portugal. Well, I'm glad I went. I knew they had great seafood, and I knew they had great viticulture, and I knew the food culture was great. I mean, just look at the neighborhood they live in. But what I didn't know was about the wines. And when we think of Portugal, we think of port wine, which is true. The wines that are port made around the Douro River is an astonishing thing, unique to the region. But what I didn't realize was Portugal has over 250 indigenous varietals grown there. Just kind of blew me away. So the microclimates were amazing. You had arid, you had dry, you had elevations, you have coastal, you had some kind of steep mountainous where they had to manufacture on a terrace. It's really great. Super friendly, food-friendly wines, really good white wines of all types of styles, and really beautiful red wines that work with it. And most importantly for me, these are the wines that pair really well with food. I don't drink wine as a standalone. I drink it with meal. So if you're looking for the new world of wines, try Portuguese wines. I think they're going to have their day. I fell in love with them. I'm going to be filming there in a couple of weeks, actually, to close out my PBS season. So I'll let you know when that show airs. You'll learn a lot more about it. But you can visit them also or join Wines of Portugal USA on Facebook or Twitter at WPTUSA, Wines of Portugal. Hey, folks, welcome back. Mike Calameco here. You're listening to Mike Calameco's Food Talk. We've got a full studio here. My current guest, the newest guest, is Chef Jimmy Bradley. A couple of restaurants in the city. The Red Cat, 15-year anniversary?
Yeah, that's right, 15.
15th-year anniversary, a absolute landmark staple of the Chelsea dining scene. And the Harrison, which was the first restaurant to open up in Tribeca. I'll let you tell the story. But back it up a little bit. You're a Philly guy. It's funny. Philly, right?
Yeah, Philly.
We talked about this. So how'd you get in the business again? Your parents were in the business? Your wine business?
My uncle, my cousin is in the wine business in Italy, and my great-grandfather migrated from Italy to Philadelphia and started a wine company in Philadelphia, owned a bunch of vineyards in, in California, and then they sold to the Gallows in the 70s, right when I was perhaps about to get into maybe working for the company, and that's one of the reasons why I never worked for the company, other than, you know, loading the trucks and
the grunt stuff.
Eating the grapes, squishing the grapes.
Pio Cesare.
Yes.
Which is a name, because I'm an old guy and I grew up in Philly, that was one of the earliest Amarones I remember. What do they make?
Barolos, Barbaresco.
Not Amarones?
Amarones from the Veneto.
So it's not you guys. So Barolos.
Mostly Nebbiolo.
Nebbiolo-based grapes, right.
Uh-huh.
Great winery, classic old school winery.
Yeah, maybe you know more about it from Philly because, like I said, my great-grandfather came to Philadelphia and had a company called Bartolomeo Pio Wines and Spirits. And so Pio Cesare had a big presence in Philadelphia because that's where the other part of the family ended up in America.
Right, and Philly has that funny scene with restaurants where you have to buy the wine from the Pennsylvania Liquor Authority. It's really strange.
Yeah.
Like your hands are tied behind your back.
Correct.
Well, we'll go into that. That's why we live in New York City.
Another story.
You moved to New York City. So cooking school at one point?
I was accepted to the CIA with a full scholarship.
I love this story.
And I never attended.
What happened?
I was working in a place in Philly called DeLulo.
Who was the chef there?
It was Frank Crispo.
Was it Crispo?
Left, and okay. Mike Strump just took it over. And so, long story short, I was the only person in the kitchen who didn't go to culinary school, and we did these dinners, a series of dinners, when Craig Claiborne retired, and it was the Book and the Cook series.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Philly
and
still does that.
Yeah, yeah. So they raised a bunch of money and gave it to the school for scholarships. So I asked the chef, maybe you could help me get one of these scholarships. He said, yes. And long story short, again, the school called me and said, we want you to pay for the first semester and then we'll reimburse you if we like you or something like that. So I said, that can't work for me. I can't do it. So I went to work and I said, chef, I need some help. And he said, I can't help you. So I basically ended up quitting my job and moving to Vail, Colorado. And I got a great job there, was a cook. And while I was cooking there, I met a guy who was a waiter at the restaurant, but really he owned a restaurant at Martha's Vineyard, and he asked me to come work for him at Martha's Vineyard. And then
two tough neighborhoods.
Yeah, exactly.
I
ended up becoming the chef of that restaurant at Martha's Vineyard by like 91. So I kind of it was really good in the end, because I was going to go to school for 2 years, then go back to DeLulo and work for the cheap for 2 years. And then maybe become a sous chef after that. And in this case, I was a cook, and then I became a sous chef, and I became a chef all in that same time period.
And you saved whatever the hell the CIA cost back in those days.
Yeah. And I was just so disappointed in the way it took place that I was very disenchanted, and you know, perhaps maybe not even continuing in the business. And the way it worked out was just phenomenal.
So fast forward. So what drew you to New York?
I came to New York for a look-see. I had a friend who was traveling, so she said, you can live in my apartment for 3 months, furnished. So I show up just to hang out, and then...
What year?
January 94.
Okay.
And I guess I was offered a position, executive chef position, at this restaurant on 17th Street that was named Flowers. Long time ago.
I don't remember it, sorry.
Yeah, it was a flash in the pan. And
that's the space that became AZ, right?
AZ, then...
And then BLT Fish.
BLT Fish,
the
yeah.
The three-story of
it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Jeez, that's right. And who was there? What was her name? Not Anita Lowe.
Patricia Yeoh.
Patricia Yeoh, who was like, had degrees in like biochemistry or something. Went to Yale. She was one of these like brilliant... Anyway, yeah. So you ended up there in that mid-block space.
And it kind of... I guess New York was... It opened its arms. It made itself pretty easy. In other words, I was offered a pretty good job, and I found an apartment. I got the sublet, and then the upstairs neighbor actually passed away, and I moved into that. You know, it was one of those classic handshakes. No lease. I come by once a month. You fill my hand with money, offer me a scotch, and that was it. I had that place for like 10 years. So I ended up staying in New York. It felt good, and it was, like I said, it was pretty easy, and I moved here in 94, and then in 99, we opened the Red Cat.
And not to shit on Philly, but I don't know what the restaurant scene was like in 94, but I'll tell you, when I left Philly in the late 70s, it was George Perrier and two other French guys and Chef Tell.
Exactly.
And bookbinders.
Right.
And Susanna Food. I mean, literally, there were six restaurants that everybody went to, and the kitchens closed at 8:45. That was the last seating. Yeah. Downtown Philadelphia, you could roll a bowling ball down Broad Street at 9, and you would hit nothing but pigeons.
Yeah, I remember.
You had to come to New York if you were serious.
Yeah, and it's just what's spoken about, the biggest food town in the world, perhaps, you know. So if you want to get serious about the business, and you should do some homework. And
so the Red Cat's a great story. You're hunting for restaurants. Tell us how that comes about, space.
I had a letter of intent with a landlord on Carmine Street. And I had a business partner at the time, Danny Abrams. And I was driving in a taxi up 10th Avenue, and I saw the federal marshals putting orange tape on the front door of the building, which is now the Red Cat.
Good sign, it might become available.
Exactly. So I stopped the taxi, and I actually had a business plan with me because we were trying to raise some money. So I wrote a note and put it under the door, and a couple of days later, the landlord called me. And
seriously?
Yeah.
This had to happen with you because you're shopping anyway.
Yeah. And it was
photocopy stuff.
It was kind of interesting in this... I said to my partner, what do you think? Because we have a letter of intent out on Carmine Street, and we love that space. He said, listen, I'm born and raised in New York. I don't even know where Carmine Street is. If we can get a place on an avenue, let's get the place on the avenue. So that's really kind of how it took place. And then after the landlord called me back, I said, can I have a tour? And I walked in, and it was like a Brigham Young moment. Literally, it was like, this is the place. And I didn't know why.
But it had been. Talk about what it had been.
Right, exactly. So it was a place called Chelsea Central for 15 years. Right. Larry McIntyre owned it. Right. Bruno Kirby and Treat Williams were the money. And
Bruce Willis tended bar when he was going to Montclair State or something.
For 7 years.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, seriously, this is all true.
And then the kitchen, phenomenal. You know, people like Rick Moonen.
Rick Moonen.
Yep. Tom Valente.
It was right before Rick went to the Water Club.
Yes.
Yes, and he got
Don
a great
Pintabona,
review.
Bona.
Yeah.
Jerry Hayden.
Yeah.
Paul Zweibin. So I had this kind of, like I said, this is the place kind of moment, but I didn't know why. And then after doing some homework and being in the space for a while, I learned all these stories. I didn't know any of them. And it just kind of confirmed that this is it. And, you know, they were over there on 10th Avenue, Chelsea Central was, when...
Yeah, when that wasn't, yes, yes, when 10th Avenue was 10th Avenue.
It wasn't a dining destination.
Correct, when people weren't walking much east of 6th or 7th, and 8th and 9th were really dicey.
Right.
And it's Chelsea. So, there's a lot of, I mean, it's another, only of late that it's become what it is.
Oh, yeah. And another hot one is I met the guy who owned the place, Larry McIntyre. I said, would you have lunch with me? I have some questions. I had lunch. And at the end, I said, I have just one question. Why did you sell the place? Because, like, the neighborhood is just turning now. You were there for all the darkest days of it. He said, listen, if I shoveled that sidewalk one more time to watch nobody walk down it, I was going to hurt somebody.
It was funny. There used to be a jazz bar called the Angry Squire that wasn't far from there that I used to go to. Back, I went to finish my line shift, go home, shower downstairs, whatever, and then go there for drinks. And it was one of those great old New York bars. Didn't have a cover charge.
Yeah, it was there was the Chelsea Commons place, too, that, like, Paul Butterfield used to play at, and Dr. John.
Right. I remember seeing Dakota. I mean, really serious talent. And I remember the bartender. I was drinking Negronis back then. And I remember the bartender knew my drink. And this was back in the day when the bartender would, like, you buy one, he buys you one. You buy one, one shows up free. So you open up with a great concept. Talk about the food, because I think that, you know, you've got this sort of cross-section of kind of greatest hits. It's not leaning towards the Mediterranean. It almost seems anchored in some kind of urban American sensibility of just really good, solid cooking and giving people what they want.
Yeah, that's great. I've never heard it that way, but that's a really nice way to say it. I guess originally it was a little bit more Italian. I like to cook Italian food, but I didn't want to have an Italian restaurant. It's kind of like the name, the Red Cat. Doesn't mean anything. And I didn't want to have an Italian restaurant and serve noodles. And so I was kind of going back and forth. But again, like, I wanted to make the food of the Mediterranean, Spain, Italy, France, Northern Africa. And so we kind of set it up under the seasonal. It's always going to change. It's always going to move around. But it's kind of rooted in this type of food. And then, you know, we just do what we want to do. And we listen to our guests.
Right.
And,
right,
you know, whatever happens, happens. Because it wasn't ever meant to be. Like, my thought was, there's always this great, amazing go-to joint in any city you go to. And it's not the one that's the number one that everybody speaks about. And it's not the one that's on television or in the books. It's usually like a mom-and-pop joint. Sometimes there's like a little broken glass window up front. You know, it's an unaffected place. But when you go in, you feel it. When you leave, you're very happy that you went there. That was the thought behind it.
You're smart because, and Harold, you can chime in. I think one of the mistakes young chefs and chefs in general make, in particular in opening restaurants, is we're just so food focused. It's just all of that. We just can't get out of our way.
Yeah.
It's all about the food. We ignore the service. It's all about, if I make this great food, they will love it and they'll come in. It's my food. And, you know, you kind of have to step back sometime and say, what you just said, wait a minute. I mean, it's not all about the food. Not everybody has a great palate. You're not cooking for you and your 12 chef friends. What do people want to eat? What are they going to respond to? And then you think of your own dining experiences. Front of the house matters a shit ton.
Yeah. Yeah.
The room matters. The location matters. The welcome at the door. I mean, because you guys are restaurateurs. You've been with us for years.
I mean, I think just in general about food right now, if someone writes about you about a specific dish, there's so much white noise happening that it kind of gets lost, and it's really about how the guest feels when they walk out of the place and what they're telling their friends.
Yeah.
This may be the wrong three people to say this to, but I was interviewing a chef, one Michelin star chef in the Napa Valley about a year ago right now, and we were just talking, you know, after the interview, and he said, you know, Andrew, I had this realization recently. I was looking around during service one night, and I thought, you know what? If it's a nice room, if the music's right, if the lighting's right, if my front of the house, house staff is good, if what I do is good or what I do is great, it can't be bad. But if it's just good, it's probably going to be enough.
It's the truth. It's a fact. I had a
not that he was just shooting for good, but he had this realization that the height that he was hitting was almost
so
incidental to him.
You'll like this story because you like history and you know New York. So our Andy Bursch's dad is Arthur Bursch, who owns Playbill magazine. And Arthur Bursch grew up with a silver spoon in his mouth, admits it, went to the Hill School, had everything right, had kind of life handed to him on a platter, and did extremely well with it. Arthur also has a great palate, traveled the world extensively, collected wine. I mean, Arthur's a big, kind of overweight Jewish guy that just loves food, spent his money on food. And Andy reviewed a restaurant that I was at in New York for 10 minutes called Breve. It just so happened I was there when he reviewed it. Mimi Sherton also reviewed it when I was there. It was getting great reviews until I realized Bobby Pritzker had one set of menus with my name on it and one set with his. And when I realized he was fucking me, I was like, you're a smack. Goodbye. F you, pal. I'm out of here. And I'm taking my crew with me. But anyway, got to meet Josh Wesson. He was a sommelier there. So Andy wrote about me, and when we opened our restaurant in Cape May a couple of years later, you know, you stick some stuff in the window, like Gourmet Magazine. Andy was writing for Gourmet, and there was an article about my restaurant. So Arthur got wind of this, and Arthur Summers in Cape May. So Arthur Bursch came to my restaurant, and he gave me this great advice once. He said, you know, your food's amazing. I love coming to your restaurant, but when you think about it, and I don't want to insult the public, but he says about 90% of the people out there have the taste buds of camels. They don't know what they're eating. They know good from bad. They know salty. They know hot from cold. But they don't know food the way you and your chef friends do. So if you think about it, Mike, front of the house, what the place looks like, how clean it is, what the soundtrack, is it a fun place to hang out? Food comes in about fifth or sixth.
Well, yeah, there's another way to think about it as the cook, you know. We wanted a neighborhood restaurant. We didn't want a destination restaurant. There's a big difference. And, you know, I really think the best compliment you could give a restaurateur is just plain and simple return patronage, you know? And so I wanted to see people often. You know, great, return patronage. If I have a destination place, maybe I see them twice a year, three times a year, occasions, birthdays, and so on. But, you know, I wanted something like every Friday night or, you know, a night at the bar alone and a night with, you know, someone else in the dining room or a larger party, you know, and seeing people two and three, four times a week. And so, you know, you have to kind of develop that, but you're certainly not just starting with this is what I do, this is how I do it. I mean, of course, there's that, that's part of the fabric, but, you know, in the art of the real neighborhood joint and the go-to place that really just makes people feel a certain way, it's not just about the food.
Yeah. Well, that's, as I said, one thing young chefs have to learn.
Yeah.
It's like, get out of your way, think about the whole picture.
Yeah,
you've
tough.
Gotten great reviews. Having said all of this, you've had constantly two stars.
Yeah.
And I remember you were supposed to, we were filming when Mike Price was the chef at the Mermaid Inn. I was doing a piece for my PBS series on like seafood shacks when they were sort of evolving, like Pearl Oyster Bar and Mary's Fish Camp, and you were one on the east side, and you were supposed to have been there. You got reviewed the night before. You were so freaking hungover,
yeah,
you couldn't make it.
I apologize.
I'm still mad. Harold, talk about Pearl. The same thing for you. I mean, this is a neighborhood. You're in the West Village on kind of a one-way street that connects nothing to nothing.
Yep.
There's a great butcher store a couple of doors down that brings me to that block. But same thing. I mean, so when you're developing, so you open, and this is your first restaurant. So out of the gate, young guy, never did this before.
Well, everybody told me to take an executive chef job before, but I've always been stubborn, so I just kind of do whatever I want.
And by the way, you two guys, shout out to the Harrison. We'll get to that in like a minute because I didn't realize that at one point you worked together.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the early part of the millennium.
Yeah. So it was May 2007 when we opened. It probably took 3 months to find the space. We had been shut down at two other spots that we had letter. We were trying to get a letter of intent. We were in lease negotiations on both of them. And then the landlord decided to go with people that had more experience because we didn't have any, you know, we hadn't opened or owned anything.
That's a heartbreaker, huh?
Yeah.
But they had everyone in New York, this is my fish tank, and everyone that's opening and looking, everyone's got this story of we had this spot and then the rug got pulled out. People look for three, I mean, why did the guys, Marcus, end up and his partner end up at what had been Courton at Bettard now is because they've been looking for 3 years. They had jobs. They both had, Jonathan had a job, but they were both, and they could not find a space. They had deals just pulled out from under them. Someone stole it, disappeared. So anyway, keep going.
Yeah, so it took a while, and, you know, our good friend Joe Campanaro was you know, said it was doing his usual. He was basically, he had just moved to Greenwich Village and was walking to the Little Owl, and he said he was taking different routes every single day to try and find a decent cup of coffee on his way over there. And he saw a sign on the Nine Jones space, the Perilla space, that said, you know, for rent. So he, you know, calls me immediately because he knows I've been looking for a bit. And he's like, so I call the phone number, and a woman in Italian answers the phone. Now, I don't understand what the heck she's saying. I don't, you know, speak really a lick of Italian except Buenos Aires. That's about it. So I said, Joe, I'm going to need your help again because I don't speak a lick of Italian, and you're really the only one I know that, you know, speaks a little bit. So he gets her on the horn, and then he passes me off to her husband, who is the landlord, this old Sicilian guy who pretty much reminded me of my grandfather to a T. I'm Sicilian as well, and we came down. He took me over tour of the space. We shook hands, and we had a gentleman's agreement. It was a done deal.
Oh, you guys. Between you with the red cat and you, that's serendipitous. That's funny.
Yeah.
But there's always that. I mean, someone once told me, too, this a long time ago, that you know, it's sort of chance favors the prepared mind sort of concept. And, you know, when destiny wants you, it just taps you on the shoulder.
Yeah.
All that big stuff.
Right.
You can plan and work and plan and stay up at nights and keep lists and have backup. But when the big shit happens, it happens to you.
Luck is when hard work pays off.
Yeah. Yeah. That was one of the things he always said. He's like, you know, Harold, he's like, people can say I'm lucky, but you always need to put yourself in a position where you can succeed.
Yeah. I think it was Darwin that said chance favors the prepared mind. It's true. I mean, I birdwatch horribly because you have to have a really good brain for it. I just enjoy birds and their behavior, and they're beautiful. And if you live in Cayman and you don't birdwatch, you're a retard because it's like ground zero. It is one of the best spots in North America. And
I used to birdwatch a lot as a kid too. So growing up in Long Island, when I used to get bad grades, my parents used to say, you can't go out and hang out with your friend. You're going to stay at home. So one winter break, I built a bird feeder and just sat out back and watched birds. My parents thought I was crazy.
No, they're cool. It's cool. We got hawks down there, shorebirds. Anyway, there was a bird that showed up in Cape May this season that shouldn't be in North America. It exists in Africa and Australia. How it got there, we don't know. And I would have never noticed it because it was with a flock of other terns on the beach. Looked very similar to the other terns that were on the beach. But then when someone pointed out, it went on Facebook, you know, my birder friend, and then you had to go to like half of the northern, because for birders they like to keep lists. This is a bird you would never see unless you went to Australia or Africa. And it was in Cape May for only a couple of days, going between the beach and the pond at Cape May Point, and it was like score. But anyway, I wouldn't have known. So cornflakes in this book? Did you mention cornflakes in your book?
Yeah.
Which is kind of funny. I kind of like that idea. One of my first job in New York City was vegetable guy at the Four Seasons restaurant. For lunch and for dinner, and then lunch, because I had worked at the Maurice too. I had two jobs for 6 months. But one of the things we used to bread for bar food was these deep fried zucchini sticks, and there was flour, egg wash, cornflake crumbs.
Oh, cool!
And I remember they tasted nasty good.
Yeah,
cornflake crumbs. Talk about how that ended up in the book, and
I was putting everything on the table. It was what did it came from the was it already in that dish?
Well, what happened was
grinding them up or
no. We're taking it's a French toast dish, and what happened was there was a year where my family, well, mostly myself, had enjoyed too much eggnog on Christmas Eve. And then Christmas Day, I said I was going to make breakfast for everybody, and I was hurting, so I had to get a little hair of the dog into the dish. So I pretty much took some brioche or whatever. It might have been some challah bread. I don't remember what we had. And we made our French toast mix, and I dumped a whole bunch of rum in it. And I said, I wonder how it's going to taste if I just, you know, sit them on some cornflakes after and then throw them into the pan. So I did it, and it was pretty good.
Cornflakes.
I've encountered that in other places, though. I think maybe at the Hotel Jerome in Aspen. This is a long time ago. I don't know if it's still there. But I was eating a French toast dish once, and it was really good. And I said to the waitress, "Hey, can you tell me?" And it was a crushed.
Yeah, they sell it. That's what we used to buy. It's the Four Seasons
coating.
And then I used to buy it too because
they sell it as like a food service.
Yeah,
thing?
They do. They sell it in food service, 50-pound bags, or they used to, of ground up cornflakes.
And it's the brand cornflakes.
I believe it was. I mean, like, don't quote me on this. I'm Kellogg's might sue. But yeah, I think it was because it's a proprietary flavor. I don't think anybody, you know, it wasn't a generic. And it's a great tasting breading. Harrison, we go to 2 minutes left, because that's a great, great story. You had this great space downtown Tribeca. You're getting ready to open, and bang, like the rest of the world changed for all of us. 9/11, nobody saw it coming. You were the first restaurant to open up. So Chanterelle was down there, Belay was down there, Drew had the Tribeca places, multiple venues. And talk about that story and the Rudy Giuliani shout-out and what that was like, and even in terms of staffing.
Yeah. You know, the staffing part's really cool. It's a good part of the story. So we signed the lease April 1st, 2001, and our opening date was September 17th, 2001. Food and Wine magazine was throwing an opening party for us. Over 200 invites had gone into the mail, and we were ready. We were on track. We were just down to the, you know, the finishes. We had a lot of trades there working, but it was really just down to the finishes. We had hired a full staff. I think we had 44 people to start with. And, you know, then September 11th happened, and we didn't know. No one knew, you know. So I guess I just went back to the Red Cat, and, well, I spoke to all the staff at the Harrison and just said, we'll get back to you. I went back to the Red Cat and just kind of went to work. But thinking about what to do with the Harrison, and took about a week off, and then decided to bring the trades back down and just at least get the place finished, whether it was ever going to open or not. So it was really difficult. I had a printed copy of my lease, my photo ID, and I'd have to walk to different checkpoints.
Yeah, physically, I did some work in Tribeca for benefits right after that. You need three types of ID. Yeah. South of Canal was a war zone.
Yeah, our first, you know, 3 months open, if you were going to be a guest at the Harrison, you would have been stopped and you would have had to show ID. Not by us, you know, by the police, but so I guess we got the place built. And we didn't know what we were going to do, and we were getting different kinds of calls and information, you know, a school that was displaced, and maybe we'll use your facility, lots of things like that. And I guess we just thought, you know what, we want to have a neighborhood place, and, you know, now is a horrible time, but, like, if you're there for the people in the neighborhood, this is the time. Let's just open the doors. And like I was saying about the staffing, you know, we hired 44 people. And then we went dark for 5 weeks. We actually did some orientation. We, like, completed most of the tasks as orientation. And then we went dark for 5 weeks. And when we called them back and we said, we're going to do this thing, show up, we're going to continue some training, we're going to open on this day, 40 out of the 44 showed up. Mm. That's just amazing. Mm. You know, like, I was amazed that day. I'm even more amazed today when I think back on it. So our opening date was October 26th, 2001, and I guess that means we'll be 14 next week as well.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, thank you.
And you've done great. I mean, it's a great restaurant. You also have a great book out. Give a shout-out to your book, because, again, it's a book, chef-driven recipe book with recipes that work.
Yeah, it's the Red Cat Cookbook, done with Andrew Friedman, released Clarkson Potter 2006.
Andrew Friedman.
Remember that name?
Harold, name of your book again.
Harold Dieterle's Kitchen Notebook.
Two great books, two great New York chefs, great cookbook author of anything he wants to do. The name of your blog, Andrew, is?
Toqueue.com.
That's T-O-Q-U-E? How do you spell Toque?
T-O-Q-U-E.
I got it right the first time. Always my first guess. L-A-N-D. Yes, Toqueland. Great to have you all out here in Morgantown, Bushwick, hipster epicenter. Right.
Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, we're here. Thank you. Next week, we'll be back with another edition of Michael Michael's Food Talk. Stay tuned for that. We'll see you then. Be well.
Whoa! Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.